Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1053, interview number 22 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 29th of the year 2019. And yet again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiGiamio, the author of, among other titles, The Triumphal Destiny Betrayed, about the assassination of JFK and Jim Garrison's investigation into same. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Okay, good evening, Dave.
Now, we were talking about the House Select Committee. We have been talking about the House Select Committee. Jonathan Blackmer, assistant counsel, observed that Clay Shaw may very well have been one of the planners of, or a cutout of the planners of, the assassination. Obviously, that is what Jim Garrison was, that is the person Jim Garrison was going after. We have seen what happened to Jim Garrison. And as you have noted in Destiny Betrayed, something very similar happened to Richard Sprague. Tell us about the campaign to oust Richard Sprague and where that came from.
Let me first say, Dick Sprague had a rather exemplary record before he got to Washington, all right? As I said on your last show, he was a highly effective assistant DA in Philadelphia. I believe he only lost one case, and he had tried a very complicated and pernicious conspiracy case in the Jock Yablonsky instance, and he had done that successfully. Right? He was very well respected in the profession. Suddenly, he gets to Washington and he announces that he's going to go ahead and treat the John F. Kennedy assassination just as he would any other murder case. In other words, he wants to hire his own investigators, all right? He wants to go ahead and have a big enough budget so that he can do technical tests. He wants to invite the press and the public, all right, to do some of the experiments which the FBI only did in secrecy so they can see for themselves what the results would be in order to restore confidence to the process, all right? And he wants to have a large amount of lawyer staff along with an investigator staff along with a technical staff, all right? Let me give you an example of what Sprague did. He called an all-day seminar on the photographic evidence in the JFK case. I think the three presenters were Robert Cutler, Robert Groden, and the other Dick Sprague, the photographic expert. All right, he put them everybody in an auditorium, all right, the whole staff, the whole lawyer staff, and he turned around and said, I don't want anybody to leave unless I leave, and I don't plan on leaving. And so the whole staff sat there for, I believe it was about 5 hours, okay? At the end of that, the 13 lawyers, 12 of the 13 lawyers believed it was a conspiracy at the end of that day. That's the kind of lawyer that Sprague was. All right. Suddenly, he gets to Washington, and all the major newspapers, which at that time, of course, would be the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post, they begin to go ahead to launch a tax on Sprague. There was a guy named David Burnham for the Washington Post who did, like, I think a four-part series digging up as much dirt as he possibly could on Sprague, and then the New York Times culminated that four-part series with an editorial saying it would be better for everyone if Sprague would resign. All right? Same thing with the Washington Post. Same thing with the L.A. Times. All right? It was, you know, as a friend of mine, Chris Sherritt, said, the day the New York Times editorial came out, they went out to dinner with Sprague and a few other guys. Sprague tried to laugh it off, okay, but Sherritt, on the way back from the restaurant, he was thinking, this is Jim Garrison all over again, okay? They're not going to let this guy do his job, all right? And so it got to be so controversial that the leadership in the House told Sprague, unless you resign, we're not going to be able to go ahead and recycle the committee. See, because that committee, since it was a special select committee, it had to be refunded every year. All right? And so, and they told him very frankly, we're not going to have the votes. All right? And so Sprague had a meeting with Tannenbaum, all right, and they had made a promise to each other that neither one would leave unless the other one would leave. But Sprague told Tannenbaum, he goes, look, Bob, I don't think you should resign because I'm going to resign. I think you should at least stick it out until they find another chief counsel, all right? Because if we both leave at the same time, I don't think the committee's going to be around, all right? And I sure as heck don't want to be blamed for causing the demise of the committee. So Tannenbaum decided to stick around for, I think, about another 9 months or something like that until they went ahead and found a new chief counsel, all right? And so that was the end. If you ask me, and I know a little bit about this, that was the end of what I believe to be the best opportunity that the country ever had to solve the John F. Kennedy murder case.
Jim, in passing, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, you opined that the offensive against Jim Garrison, both in the media and the legal system, was designed to see to it that no DA or anyone else would attempt to do, no other DA would attempt to do what Jim Garrison did. And noting that the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post really were the main elements in the media broadside against Richard Sprague, I opined that not only did I agree with your assessment of what was done to Garrison and why, but that something very similar was done to the late Gary Webb right here in the Silicon Valley at the San Jose Mercury News when he did his piece on the Contra and the cocaine traffic in the CIA. And the LA Times, Washington Post, and New York Times were the main papers that pilloried Gary Webb and his story as well. And they are like, you know, the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil in this case.
I totally agree with that. And I believe that that is really one of the indications that our society, our institutions, cannot deal with these subjects in any kind of honest way. They're somehow, they strike to the heart of what is wrong with this country. And the powers that be will not let anybody go there.
Indeed.
Or at least not let anybody go there successfully.
You wrote on page 334, Jim, that Joe Rauh, R-A-U-H, And he said, or as Jill Rao, who knew Sprague from Philadelphia and had a front row seat to the controversy in Washington, said, quote, you know, I never thought the Kennedy case was a conspiracy until now. But if they can do that to Dick Sprague, it must have been. And
yes, Joe Rao, if your listeners don't know who he is, was probably the foremost civil rights attorney practicing in Washington for over a period of decades. All right. I would say minimum from the 50s to the 60s to the 70s. All right. And he was from Philadelphia. So he knew about Dick Sprague. And he made that comment to a friend of mine, Jerry Polakoff, which I believe, you know, it pretty much sums up what happened to Sprague. You know, if you can do that to a guy with a record like Sprague, then there must have been something up with the JFK case.
And you note that he, even with Sprague, they tried to accuse him of being in bed with the mafia, as they did with Garrison.
Yes, they did.
We'll come to
one of the dumbest things I ever heard of.
We'll come to some of the initiators of some of that a little later in a very crucial time frame. Richard Sprague has gotten the Garrison treatment. He has resigned. And a very important person in the investigation, George DeMorenshield, was found dead of a shotgun blast to the head. More about the circumstances in a minute.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
I wonder if you would do a couple things, Jim. First, review for us George DeMorenshield, his intelligence and oil background, his role introducing the Oswalds to the white Russian community in Dallas-Fort Worth, and perhaps above all else, his handing off of the Oswalds to the Paines.
Okay, very briefly, I'll give a synopsis of this. I think we went over this previously.
We did.
George DeMorenshield was born into the upper class of the white Russian aristocracy in the pre-Soviet Union Russia. And then they left, of course, after Lenin took over the country. They migrated eventually to Europe and then to the United States. And him and his brother Dmitry became very friendly with the intelligence community. His brother Dmitry was actually a friend of Alan Dulles, and Alan Dulles definitely knew who George DeMorenshield was because he recommended him to a geological attorney. All right, and so DeMorenshield, it was later revealed, would do favors for the Central Intelligence. In turn, it was sort of like, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. They would give him assignments, say, for example, to Eastern Europe, okay, and then they would go ahead and tip him in on a business opportunity that he could get into, all right? He was very close friends with J. Walton Moore, who was the head of the Dallas CIA office, all right? And it was J. Walton Moore who went ahead and suggested that he meet up with this guy coming back from the Soviet Union, Lee Harvey Oswald, and his Russian wife, Marina. Okay, and so DeMorenshield did do that. And for a while, he and these other white Russian people, who DeMorenshield knew very well, became quite friendly with Lee and Marina, all right? And then I believe it was April of 1963, DeMorenshield put together a gathering at which Ruth and Michael Paine eventually became friendly with Lee and Marina Oswald. In May, he left Dallas-Fort Worth for a number of years with his wife, Jean, and they went to live in Haiti, one what many people consider another CIA assignment, right? It was then the Paines who then became very friendly with Lee and Marina, and it was Ruth Paine who actually was involved with separating the couple on their return from New Orleans in the fall of 1963. So George de Morenchild, to put it mildly, was a rather important figure in Oswald's life.
Absolutely. And bearing in mind what we spoke about last week with the Mexico City gambit, the Paines, Ruth Paine's separation of Lee and Marina was fundamental for the execution of that disinformation gambit with all of that implied. Yes, at this point in time, again, Richard Sprague has resigned. He has yet to be formally replaced. We'll talk about that. George de Morenchild was working with, or at least in contact with, some interesting people, Willem Oltmans, a Dutch journalist, and Edward Epstein, a U.S. journalist. Could you tell us about that, and then what happened to George de Morenchild at this point in time?
This is so intriguing, I believe. And not very many people have really reported on it, so I decided to try and at least do a little bit about it. Okay, to explain the last months of George de Morenchild's life. According to his last wife, Jean, de Morenchild began to show signs of emotional instability when he began to see a doctor named Charles Mendoza. He was going to him for a bronchitis condition, but Mendoza was recommending some rather odd drugs, prescription drugs, okay, for George. And finally, Jean began to see the effect of these drugs. And so she went to Mendoza's office and read the Riot Act to him. What the heck are you doing to my husband? You know? And so Mendoza got very uppity. And according to Jim Mars, who I got this information from, he later left town, okay, because Jim couldn't find him, all right? That was step one, all right? At this time also, with the church committee and the House Select Committee beginning to heat up, the de Morenchilds, husband and wife, now began to reverse what they had said to the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission, they were pretty much straightforward, accusatory of what Oswald had done, and they agree with the Warren Commission verdict. But now, they began to say that it was a conspiracy, and it was a vast conspiracy, all right? Which is very odd when you think about it. So George kept on getting more and more unstable, okay, according to Gene. And Jean had him checked into Parkland Hospital, the mental part of the institution. And she then filed for divorce, right? Now, who should enter his life at this time, okay, but a guy named Willem Oltmans. Oltmans had known de Morenchild from a few years before because he had come to Dallas to interview Marguerite Oswald. And then he went over and he talked to de Morenchild. Willem Oltmans was a nationally known correspondent from the Netherlands. All right. And he convinced de Morenchild to go ahead and fly with him back to his home country. And they were going to publish a book and do a 1-hour special program. And de Morenchild was going to be highly paid for these pursuits. Well, he did, but not before he got a letter from a guy named Edward Epstein. All right? Epstein was also doing a book at this time, and he wanted to talk to de Morenchild. But de Morenchild decided to go ahead and fly to the Netherlands with Oltmans. this did not turn out anywhere near what was supposed to turn out. And de Morenschild later wrote a series of letters accusing Oltmans of trying to drug him, of making homosexual overtures to him, you know, of trying to go ahead and upset him, and trying to get him to say things he didn't want to say. All right? So de Morenschild fled the Netherlands, comes back to the United States, looks up his daughter, Alexandra, who's staying in a town called Monopolon, which is outside Palm Beach in Florida. All right? And he now is approached by Edward Epstein. Edward Epstein pays him, I believe, $1,000 a session to do interviews for this book he's writing called Legend, The Secret World of Lee Harvey Oswald. And he puts him up at a very expensive hotel, the Breakers, in West Palm Beach. And on the second time, I think it was the second session, he let him go home, and he's supposed to come back later. He drives home, and there's I think it's either a summons or a card from Gayton Fonzi, who is now knows that de Morenschild is back in the United States, and he says he wants to talk to him for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Within a half an hour, George de Morenschild was dead. The official verdict was that he took his own life, all right? But there were some rather interesting questions about the circumstances surrounding his death.
Jim, I'd like to read from page 337 some of those interesting circumstances. You write.
Go ahead.
Even though a coroner's inquest ruled his death as self-inflicted, again, a self-inflicted shotgun blast in the head, there are some serious questions about de Morenschild's demise. First, according to the crime scene report and the autopsy, there was not any exit wound to the rear of the skull. Yet, de Morenschild allegedly placed a shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. It's true that shotgun shells disperse more quickly than jacketed bullets, but his shot was almost within contact distance. Neither the maid nor the cook heard the shotgun blast, even though both women were right below the room that de Morenschild was in at the time. The police also had problems explaining the blood spatter on the wall. When a blood spurt hits a flat surface, it creates a different pattern than if it hits a surface that is perpendicular to it. And looking at photographs of the spatter pattern, it appears that the bathroom door was closed at the time the shooting took place because the blood pattern looked continuous. But the police said this was not the case. The bathroom door was open at the time. The testifying officer demanded that the jurors demeaned the jurors for asking this question and then jumped to a new topic. But it would appear that someone altered the crime scene afterwards. The final oddity about the scene is the position of the weapon after death. It fell trigger side up, parallel to the chair de Morenschild was in, with the barrel resting at his feet and the butt of the rifle away from him and to his left. The police had a problem with this issue, and so did the inquest jurors. As author Jerry Rose has noted, this strange positioning of the rifle suggests it was placed, unquote, by someone. Ms. Tilton, that's whose home this was not at home at the time of de Morenschild's death, but she had left strict instructions for the maid to record her favorite TV programs. The home had an alarm system which caused a quiet bell to ring any time an outside door or window was opened. During the hearing, the tape of the program was played. when it was, the alarm bell went off, and then the gun blast was heard. Rather interesting circumstances for a, quote, suicide, unquote.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, especially the positioning of the rifle. You know, I mean, you would think that the rifle would probably be perpendicular to his body, okay, after he pulled the trigger. But yet it was parallel to his body, okay? And no exit wound? And, you know, and plus that very strange tape, okay, that has apparently somebody coming in and then the gun blast going off, all right? So and then the interview that Mark Lane did with Bloodworth, the local DA,
right,
who said that he talked to Epstein, and Epstein said he had no notes or tapes of the interviews. And Bloodworth said, of course, I didn't believe that. You know, you don't pay a guy $1,000 an hour, and then you don't keep notes or tapes of what you're paying him for. All right. And he added that he knew who, and this is the most interesting thing of all, you know, he knew the phone calls that he had made, that Epstein had made while he was in Florida. Okay. And they were quite interesting. All right. Although he wouldn't reveal who he actually contacted. So as I conclude, there's three alternatives you can think of here. DeMoranchel took his own life, somebody murdered DeMoranchel, or the third, that DeMoranchel was driven to take his own life by Mendoza, the combination of Mendoza, Epstein, and Oltmans. Now, what makes this so fascinating, of course, is that Oltmans, after DeMoranchel's death, Oltmans returns to the United States, and he suddenly attains a very high profile, one he really didn't have before. And, of course, the natural reason was because people were very interested about the timing of DeMoranchel's death.
Jim, very briefly, this was in between Blakey's departure and
actually, it's even worse than that. It's on the day that they voted to go ahead and refinance the committee. It was on that day.
On that day. And Gaetan Fonzi, am I remembering correctly, was the person who called, contacted DeMoranchel saying the House Select Committee wanted to speak with him. And within a half an hour, DeMoranchel's dead.
Right. So suddenly, here comes Oltmans back to the United States. He's on national television. He's in executive session with the House Select Committee. And then he writes a magazine article later about this whole thing. All of them very accusatory of DeMoranchel's alleged role and what he told them about it in the Kennedy assassination. All right? Which is pretty much the opposite of what DeMoranchel was saying, that you know, he had nothing to do with it and Oswald was innocent. All right? So then Jerry Polakoff, a reporter that at that time for New Times, got hold of some letters that DeMoranchel had written in the Netherlands to the United States, bringing up these very weird things that Oltmans is doing with him. Okay, and so he referred to them in an article that he wrote. And so Oltmans was very upset about this. All right, and he invited him to meet him, and I think it was a cafeteria-style restaurant in New York City. All right, and so Jerry went and met him, and at first Oltmans was his usual charming self, but he then tried to say that the letters were forgeries, okay? And Jerry said, I don't believe they're forgeries at all. I think they're genuine. And he said, Altman's demeanor went from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde in a matter of a few seconds when he said that. He suddenly became very menacing and threatening and uncomfortable, all right, and he began to really make what Jerry wouldn't tell me exactly what he said, but he said they were some scary comments, all right, to the point that Jerry had to leave, all right? He got up and left. So I leave it to the listener. What does he think, he or she think? What do you make of those circumstances? But it's another thing that, if you can believe it, has never been solved, you know?
And again, this is the day that the House Select Committee is getting refinanced. A half hour after Gaetan Fonzi indicates to DeMorin Schild that the House Select Committee wants to contact him. DeMorin Schild is found dead under these very strange circumstances, and then the journalists, both Edward Epstein and particularly Willem Altman's, behave in a very curious fashion with regard to George DeMorin Schild, who is no longer around to contribute whatever information he might have. And this, in this very crucial juncture.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, Richard Sprague is out as chief counsel for the HSCA. You mentioned something I did not know, Jim, which is that Arthur Goldberg was being considered as a replacement for Richard Sprague. Tell us about Goldberg and what happened with him.
Well, that's true. And I was told that by a guy named Al Lewis, who was the other guy that Sprague brought in with him to be one of his assistants. All right. And Al Lewis was there and trying to help find a replacement for Sprague. And so they thought of this guy named Alfred Goldberg. Alfred Goldberg was a very distinguished Ivy League lawyer who had worked in the Kennedy administration. He was Secretary of Labor. He then went to the Supreme Court, and he stepped down from the Supreme Court and then went to the UN. So he had a very, very distinguished career. All right? And so his name came up, and Lewis called him down, all right, and they did an interview with him, and Goldberg said that, look, the only way I'm going to take the job is if I get guaranteed that the CIA is going to cooperate with me. If they're not going to cooperate with me, then I'm not interested, all right? And so Lewis went ahead and said, well, I guess the only way we can determine that is let's call up Stansfield Turner, who was a CIA director at the time. All right, and so there they are. You have Lewis and the prospective new director, Goldberg, on the phone. They call up Stansfield Turner, and Lewis goes ahead and says, look, I've got Al Goldberg here, and I'm trying to get him to run the House Select Committee, and he wants to know if you can guarantee that the CIA is going to cooperate with his investigation. He wants to know that before he takes the job. So I'm asking you. And everything went silent. And this went on for about 15, 20, 30 seconds. And And finally, Goldberg goes, do you think we lost a connection? Do you think he hung up? And he goes, I don't know. He goes, well, why don't you say something? All right. And so Al goes, Mr. Director, you still there? He goes, yes, I am. He goes, I was waiting for an answer to my question. And Turner says, I thought my silence was my answer.
Indeed, indeed. We might want to mention in a couple things in connection with this. One, Arthur Goldberg had actually worked for the Office of Strategic Services, U.S.'s World War II intelligence agency. And even though Alan Dulles was several years dead at this point, about 8-9 years dead, he was obviously arguably the most important of the Warren commissioners. And Arthur Goldberg stated in no uncertain terms that Alan Dulles was a traitor to the U.S. because of his collusion with the Nazis before, during, and after World War II. Also, although Stanfield Turner was head of the CIA at this point when he spoke with Arthur Goldberg, previously the CIA director during the first goings-on of the House Select Committee was George Herbert Walker Bush, and one of the main, arguably the main liaison between the agency and the Warren Committee, or the House Select Committee, rather, was George Joannides, who had been the CIA officer who was in charge of the DRE, the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, which was the group that the Oswald associate and then later opponent Carlos Bringer was involved with. So we have some foxes watching the hen house here. Jim, as I've said, as we move into what happened next, I think maybe for a person at this point in time, particularly the younger people, maybe the most important part of your very important book is that synthesis I have spoken about in the past, a synthesis between the intelligence services, the individual infiltrators in the garrison's investigation, Clay Shaw's defense team, the media hatchet people who destroyed Garrison, and the Department of Justice itself. In that regard, let's go back to Life magazine and the fall of 1967, as you write on page 276. Speaking of David Chandler, one of the media hatchet people, but Chandler's most serious blast against Garrison and his inquiry was a two-part article written for Life in the fall of 1967. This appeared on September 1st and September 8th issues of the magazine. The piece is masqueraded as an exposé of mafia influence in large cities in America at the time, but the real target of the piece was not the mob, but Jim Garrison. The idea was to depict him as a corrupt New Orleans DA who had some kind of nebulous ties to the mafia and Carlos Marcello. There were four principal participants in the pieces: Chandler, Sandy Smith, Dick Billings, remember that name, audience, and Robert Blakey, remember that name, audience. Smith was the actual build writer, and since Smith was a longtime asset of the FBI, it is very likely that the Bureau was the originating force behind the magazine running the piece. And skipping down, it was the work of David Chandler, a friend of both Clay Shaw and Kerry Thornley, which was the basis of the completely phony concept that Garrison was somehow in bed with the mafia, and his function was to steer attention from their killing of Kennedy. Of course, Clay Shaw was who Garrison was after in the trial. Kerry Thornley, longtime buddy of Lee Harvey Oswald, the Marxist Marine, through his New Orleans career, deeply involved with Oswald's activities there, including the FPCC activities. And note two of the collaborators, again, making out the killing to be the work of the mob and Jim Garrison, you know, a mob flunky, Dick Billings and Robert Blakey, who replaced Richard Sprague as chief counsel.
Well, you just said his name, Robert Blakey.
Indeed.
And all right. And also Dick Billings ended up being more or less Blakey's right-hand man on that committee. And they reportedly both ended up being on the four-man team who ended up writing the final report. That's how important they were. Right.
And again, we're seeing them in 67 blasting Garrison, touring Garrison with the mafia brush, and attributing ultimately the killing to the mob and Carlos Marcello later. But we've seen Billings and Blakey as two of the media hatchet people doing a number on Garrison for Life magazine. And then, lo and behold, after Richard Sprague gets ousted, who ascends into his position. Again, that synthesis I've spoken about so often and that I think maybe is the most important historical and political lesson to be learned from reading your book. Robert Blakey made a number of interesting changes to the way things were being done. Perhaps, as you write on page 350, one of the most interesting was his approach to how he was going to allow the intelligence services to coordinate with his investigation. Tell us about that, Jim.
Well, there were several things that he did that was different than the approach Sprague and Tannenbaum were taking. The one you're alluding to is that in turn for allowing the investigators on his staff to go ahead and take a look at files, he would then go ahead and allow them to edit the final report. Okay, they'd be in the room, and he would allow them to go ahead and make suggestions or even cut out certain things that they did not want included in the final report. This had very poor results. The best example I can think of is when dealing with the Mexico City report by Dan Hardaway and Eddie Lopez. As Eddie Lopez told me when I asked him, why wasn't the Mexico City report included in any way, shape, or form in the volumes? And he said, Jim, on that day, there were three guys from the CIA lined up in a room opposite me, Dan Hardaway, and Blakey. All right? It took us, and I'm not exaggerating, it took us about 8 hours to get through the first page of the report. All right? And after that day, because the report is 300 pages long, you know, Blakey threw in the towel. All right? And that's why the report was not a part of the volumes. So that's the kind of power that in that example, the CIA had over what got in the final report. We didn't see the Lopez report, or it's commonly called the Mexico City report, until 1993, when it was finally declassified, at least in part, by the Assassinations Record Review Board. All right? And so that was the kind of arrangements that the House Select Committee made in order to get access to secret files.
And the, that certainly is a major concession on the part of Stansfield Turner. G. Robert Blakey. Bear in mind again that George Joannides, not a disinterested person at all, is involved as the liaison with CIA. And you mentioned, you write, Jim, that the autopsy evidence that was conveyed to the House Select Committee on Assassination had to go through a guy named Regis Bahut. I'm not sure how that is pronounced. B-L-A-H-U-T is his last name. Tell us about what happened with Mr. Bahut.
Okay, with the Regis Blahut affair.
Right.
All right. The autopsy materials were supposed to be in a CIA-secured safe, all right? And you had to sign in and sign out, okay, whenever you wanted to see anything, all right? And so what happened is that somebody noticed that the pictures had not been restored to their proper folders, okay? In other words, whoever the guy was who refiled the pictures did not know how to refile them correctly, or he had been caught in the act, okay, and didn't have enough time to go ahead and refile them correctly. In other words, somebody unauthorized was looking at the pictures, all right? So there was an investigation. And it turned out that all the evidence went ahead and said it was his CIA liaison, Regis Blahut. You know, they actually found his fingerprints, you know, on the pictures, all right? And so the CIA went ahead and they gave Blakey some different options of how they wanted to investigate the whole affair, okay? And they actually said, well, you could have us do it. But they said, we wouldn't recommend that because it wouldn't have a lot of credibility. Well, guess what? Blakey chose that option, okay, to have the CIA investigate it, all right? Now, the most interesting part of this whole, what they call the Blahut affair, is that the word was that this was not part of a wider operation. Okay, in other words, it was one guy screwing up, all right? It wasn't part of any kind of coordinated operation against the committee. Well, it later turned out that there was a house investigation of the whole Blahut affair, all right? And they concluded that it was part of an operation. I think in my book, wasn't it called the Man-Child or something like that? Operation? Okay, they even had a code name for it, all right? And so, but we never got to really find out what it was all about, because of the CIA investigating itself. Now let me say something about this, because I don't want to leave the impression, okay, to be that I'm beating up on Blakey. Blakey has finally seen the error of his ways, okay, and he signed this whole Truth and Reconciliation Committee thing, for example. He even offered to do a blurb for Lisa Peace's book. And in a debate he did in Dallas with Howard Willens, he told Willens, look, you were lied to by both the CIA and the FBI. All right? And he had at least the honesty to say that. You know, unfortunately, I wish he would have realized the error of his ways much earlier, okay, but, you know, he has turned himself around a bit, you know, in these later days.
He did. I remember when the information surfaced in the media maybe about 10 years ago about George Joannides being the CIA liaison to the committee, or one of them anyway, the main one, and also having been in charge of the DRE for the CIA, that Blakey opined that, boy, if he'd known that, you know, that would have affected his behavior. So he may have.
Well, do you want to explain what that is? The whole Joannides affair?
Oh, well, yeah, George Joannides. He was a CIA officer who was in charge of the DRE, one of the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban organizations, the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, one of whose members was Carlos Bringier. He was the guy who had that stage incident in New Orleans where Alvin Oswald was handing out pro-Castro leaflets. And then later, was on the Conversation Carte Blanche with Jim Stuckey and Ed Butler on WBSU, and he asked Oswald, who was already admitted to having been in the Soviet Union and expressed his Marxist and pro-Cuban sympathies. He said in his speech of such, Fidel Castro characterized John Fitzgerald Kennedy as a ruffian and a thief. Do you agree with Mr. Castro, obviously setting Oswald up? Bringier also later channeled money to the campaign by Harry Connick in his campaign to replace Jim Garrison.
But the point is that when the House Select Committee was investigating the DRE,
right,
the CIA said that, A, Joannides didn't have anything to do with them back in 1963, okay, and that, B, that he was more or less retired at this time. Well, it turned out that they were both false statements, that Joannides was in working with the DRE in 1963, and the CIA deliberately brought him out of retirement to work for them. And, in fact, Dan Hardway told me, when Joannides began to go ahead and interface with the committee is when they began to get all kinds of redacted documents and the wrong documents, and this began to be nothing more than a way to kill time, okay, so they could go ahead and wait out the demise of the committee. And when Blakey didn't find this out until many, many years later, due to Jefferson Morley's investigation. And so he now says, you know, I wouldn't believe anything the CIA says anymore, you know, after what they did to me.
Yep. And having a guy like Joannides in the position he was in, it's like having a Chicken McNuggets salesman watching the hen house. I mean, it's just not good. There was a book that came out by a BBC journalist whose name escapes me, and this followed a piece on the BBC that alleged that Joannides was also present at the Ambassador Hotel the night Robert Kennedy was killed. Have you been able to verify or disprove that allegation?
No, that's turned out to be not accurate.
Okay, so that was not accurate. It was interesting, you know, the Ambassador Hotel was ultimately demolished by the guy who bought it. That guy was Donald Trump.
Right. And what happened is that he ended up going bankrupt, okay, on that project. And so then the city school district ended up buying it out of a bankruptcy sale.
All righty. Jim, we have just a few minutes left. Is it possible, do you think, to encapsulate how did Blakey handle the New Orleans information with Bannister, Ferry, Oswald, and Sam Newman, and also about the sniper's nest?
First of all, the two guys who were supposed to be investigating New Orleans, that is Lawrence Delsa and Bob Burris, ended up being suspended. Okay, and what happened with New Orleans is that Blakey sent in some rather inexperienced people. He even brought in a guy from the King side of the case, okay, to go ahead and finish that off, and he very tightly controlled that part of the investigation, which, you know, I believe was a very bad mistake, okay, because according to Delsa, they were coming up with some very interesting stuff in New Orleans, right? Blakey then kind of worked in secret as opposed to the openness that that Sprague was trying to advocate. And there were only, I think, 2.5 weeks of public hearings, all right? And he accepted the sniper's nest evidence. When I say that, what do I mean? I mean the magic bullet CE-399, the rifle, okay, as being Oswald's, ordered by Oswald, and the shells that were found at the scene, okay? All right, and he accepted those as genuine, did not question them, all right? which, as I prove in both my books, this was a bad mistake because I believe every step of the way it's questionable. Then he used what's called the neutron activation analysis test to link the fragments to the bullets. Well, we found out around 2005 that that test, commonly called comparative bullet lead analysis, is junk science. It won't be used by the FBI in court anymore, and even Blakey will admit that to you today. All right. So it ended up being that the House Select Committee said that it was probably a conspiracy based on the acoustical exam that they did, but Oswald was still the main shooter in the conspiracy, all right? Now, today, if you talk to Blakey, he believes that there were, at the other end, that is on the picket fence, he believes that there were a couple of Cuban exiles in Dallas that day. And he thinks that they were firing from the other end of Dealey Plaza, but they missed. Okay? And that's the conclusion of the House Select Committee in 1979.
And but was it Blakey who co-authored with Dick Billings the book Contract on America? Was that the...
No, that was David Shime's book.
David Shime.
Okay. Right. Blakey and Billings wrote a book called Fatal Hour. In its paperback version, it was called Fatal Hour, in which he advocated a mob conspiracy.
Right, and certainly the mob was involved. I mean, David Ferry was involved with Carlos Marcello. Marcello was involved with various activities. We talked about briefly Jack Ruby, Sergio Arcacha Smith, and these things overlap CIA. But as we will be talking about in our interviews next week when we come to how the Kennedy assassination changed some very important foreign policy outlooks and initiatives that with which we began our discussion a couple of months ago. The mafia does not control American foreign policy. And
right.
So, obviously, that is no more than modified limited hangout. We will get into that. Jim, we have 3 minutes left. If you would tell people about Kennedys and King, about how to order your books, about Black Op Radio, and about a job opening.
Okay. My website is kennedysandking.com, and if you go there, you'll see a couple of ads for my books. The one we're talking about today, Destiny Betrayed, the second edition, and also another book that's more recent, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. And you can go ahead and click through, and you can go ahead and order those books. I'm a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's Black Op radio program, which is on Thursday nights at 6:30, all right, out of Canada. And we have my webmaster, who's been working for me for a few years, has now told me that he has to take a medical leave. He's retiring. And so I'm going to need a replacement on a voluntary basis. Okay, we can't afford to pay you. But somebody who's familiar with Joomla and knows how to HTML, it's nothing very complicated. All right, only probably a few hours a week. And you'll be working for a very good cause.
Indeed, you'll be doing the Lord's work. So you may not be getting paid in this realm, but the dividends to be paid down the line might be very big indeed. So that is something to consider. Next week, we will be talking about how JFK's assassination affected this country's foreign policy. We might also want to work in some of the domestic things as well, because indeed, it was destiny betrayed. This concludes For the Record program number 1053, interview number 22 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 29th of the year 2019. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.